All Over the Map from Lorraine Chittock's cabin in Chile. All Over the Map brings you the most exciting stories from around the world. Lorraine has lived in many cool and hot places all over the map. Now, she'd like you to meet some of her cool and hot friends. Adventurers, authors, and many more share their amazing tales in heart-to-heart conversations with Lorraine Chittock. Real adventures told by the people who live them, from Italy, India, Egypt, Madagascar, and all over the map.
My first interview recorded in Chile is with someone who falls into each of the three categories. Doug is an author, adventurer, and educator who by serendipity fell in love with camels and now uses these ships of the desert, as they're sometimes called, to bridge the gap between people from different walks of life and different cultures. I first met Doug in 2004 when he was taking a group of teenagers from an at-risk facility in Arizona out for a camping expedition.
You were telling me before about how, you know, these kids, it puts them in their place to be working with these animals that are, what, 2,000 pounds?
Yeah, on the top end, a camel can be a ton. And if you want to see an attitude adjustment to a 15-year-old gang kid from Philadelphia, a camel is just the animal to do it. And it's not because they're inherently mean, but it's because they're inherently honest. And it forces you to be honest when you deal with them.
So those 2 years that I traveled around the States, I stayed with you and your family on your farm outside of Waco, Texas.
That's right.
And in all honesty, and there's going to be some people that are going to be really unhappy when I say this, I have to honestly say that your three kids were the best kids that I came across in my travels. Now,
checks in the mail.
Now, did you happen to bribe them those days that I was there? Or
That's right. I pay them and you. No, you know what?
No wonder I've got to work so hard.
The truth is, you know, as a parent, the very best thing that you can hear is that your children are nice and they're cool to hang out with. And because of my business with our family's camels, it puts my kids in social situations where they have to deal with people of all ages, but frequently adults. And when you say something nice about my kids, I always laugh. And I think that they have become three wonderful young people despite their upbringing on a camel farm.
How much of that disciplinary action that you are saying, I don't know, I guess what you bring to the table when you're with the high school kids in Arizona, how much of it is the same that you use with your own kids?
Virtually every piece of it. And I'll tell you why. Basically, as caregivers in the program Vision Quest that I worked with, you know, for 14 years, each caregiver, almost regardless of what their role is in the program, we're all charged with parenting these kids. Whether you're a wrangler, which was kind of the area I was in their camel program, or whether you're a house parent or admin or maintenance or a cook, you will come into contact with the youth in that program multiple times in a day for multiple months or a year in some cases with some of the kids in the program. But almost regardless of what position you hold in that program, you were charged with parenting. And we had lots of mantras, and there was a lot of lingo and, you know, job-specific jargon. But being firm, fair, and consistent is not just lingo or jargon for working with youth at risk, but it's also a great way to work as a parent. And fortunately, when I started working with Vision Quest, it was about the time that my kiddos were starting to grow, 3, 4, 5, 6 years of age. So I really learned great parenting skills working for Vision Quest. And I use that with the kiddos in the program, and I've used it with my kiddos. And I don't believe that there's a one-size-fits-all method for parenting because, you know, every kid is an individual and every parent is an individual. But I'll tell you, the basic foundation that we worked from with those kids in Vision Quest is a great way to work with your own kids. And I found that all those same principles and techniques have worked with mine. So if there's any success, I think we should, you know, owe it all to Vision Quest, not my parenting ability.
Well, okay, and it's interesting, you know, life kind of, you know, we go on this journey from one thing to the next, and that leads us to something else. Before you worked at Vision Quest, of course, you were working at a zoo in Tennessee. Is that not correct?
That's exactly right. I had actually started my zoo career as a volunteer just out of college at what was the original Central Texas Zoo in Waco, Texas, where I'd gone to college. And I got a little experience working around animals. Times were very different then. Back in the 80s when you'd volunteer, you might find yourself doing any number of tasks. Today, because of liability and you know, all of the concerns you can imagine in a modern kind of fear, you know, centric system, volunteers don't get to do quite as much as I would have done back in the beginning. But that was at the old zoo in Waco. And then I made a move to Tennessee, to Nashville, specifically to play music full-time. I wanted to be a professional musician. I'd studied music in school, and that was kind of always the career path. But when I got to Nashville, I realized that music happens at night, and I had all day long, you know, to busy myself. So I ended up going out to the zoo in Nashville and asked for a volunteer position. And thankfully, the 3 years of volunteering I'd done in Waco put me in a position where I could maybe take on a paid position there at the zoo, and they had a position open in the primate department, and they offered me a job, and I took a job, a paying job, doing essentially what I'd done for free for 3 years prior.
In the primate section.
Yeah, that lasted about 5 months, okay.
And
primates.
So primates are like humans.
They are just like humans, but they're like humans who, you know, develop to be like a 4 or 5 year old and never move beyond that.
Right.
You know, and primates like to share. They like to share all of their bodily functions. And there's a lot of psychology that goes on when you work with primates. And, you know, a fellow with a 2-year music degree, maybe I just wasn't cut out for working with primates. But I knew I loved animals, and I knew that there was a home for me somewhere in the zoo. So this would have been like summer of 93. And the zoo director at Nashville said, hey, we're going to bring camels in, and we want to give rides and, you know, make a concession, make money for the zoo. And he had made this announcement at a keeper meeting, you know, a weekly keeper meeting, kind of a staff get-together. And I thought, well, I'm the newest guy here. I don't have any experience with large animals. I don't have any practical knowledge of horses. So I thought, there's no way they're going to let me do this. But I shot my hand up and said, I'll do it. And, of course, nobody else wanted the job because everybody has kind of always bought into the old myth of camels being mean and nasty and ornery. And so nobody wanted the job. So I got the job, and I fell in love immediately.
And so, not to keep picking on your great kids, but so what was more helpful in raising kids, working with the primates or working with the camels?
Oh, boy. Well, yeah, I don't know that there's, as a young parent with, you know, at that point, just our first daughter was about to be born. In fact, I started working with camels, and I became a parent virtually at the same time, within perhaps 6 weeks of each other. And I was young. I was 25, and I don't know that I was hopeful for anything. I don't know that I looked a week into the future. But I can tell you that my dear bride, Trish, who has grown up on a farm, she has worked with animals all her life. She comes from a big, big, big Czech Catholic family, so she's had young people around her all her life, little cousins, toddlers and infants, surrounding her. So if I would get frustrated with the camels, or I'd get frustrated with our firstborn, Vanessa, my wife had patients in droves. She would say, these two concepts are a little bit similar. You're dealing with an infant or you're dealing with a camel, and let's, face fact, camels are not rocket scientists. They're sweet, they're endearing. But at a point, my daughter and the camels probably had about the same, mindset. And it took a whole lot of patience. And there was a big, steep learning curve for me, both in parenting and in camel training. But I don't know. You seem to think I've done okay with it, so I'm going to go with what you say.
Well, I think what you said is correct. It has a lot to do with patience and persistence.
Firm, fair, and consistent.
Firm,
it comes back to that. And so much of what I learned at Vision Quest later on would, just really, really help me to be a much better parent.
Now, you have always seemed on the surface, I say on the surface because, there are so many layers to each of us, like a very calm kind of guy, relaxed, nothing kind of bothers you so much. Is that the reality, or is there something else? And how much have you changed in, I don't know, how many years has it been since the whole camel kid thing began happening at the same time?
20 years,
okay.
It is a journey. Let me tell you, if you say something nice about my, comportment or my my temperament, I will nod and say thank you, because I know it hasn't always been that way, and things don't come easy. Certainly not the things I've chosen to do in my life haven't necessarily come easy. I've had to work hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a redhead, so I think you can appreciate the fact that, there might be some underlying, anger and temper issues there. I work hard to not be
volatile.
Exactly. But, at the end of the day, with camels and with kids, you can't lie to them, and you can't bluster your way through. There are truths to working with kids and with animals, and they will see right through you, whether it's your own kids or a group of camels or kids in a residential treatment program like Vision Quest that I worked at for 14 years. You can't lie, and at the end of the day, you really can't lie to yourself either. So that's not the way to go. So I think you have to be laid back and kind of take things as they come, and that only comes with age and experience. Again, it's been quite the journey.
And, your journey, it's not, your daily journey is huge, depending on what day of the week it is, what time of the year. You do the nativity scenes for churches at Christmas time. After that, you're going to Egypt to do tour groups the rest of the year. You're doing programs in schools and Civil War reenactments. All of that. And on Facebook, you've been a regular on Facebook now for just over 3 years. And I remember when you first started, you were like, I'll give it 6 months. And I don't know that many people who have been so, tell me what all that is about. Why you persist in bringing a message out there to people.
Oh, boy.
I know. I didn't narrow that down much, did I?
Well, my business card basically details each of those various aspects to our family's camel business that you just described, whether it's providing the camels and the various manger scene animals at Christmas for churches across Texas, or if it's visiting schools or libraries or historic sites, sharing stories about the U.S. Army camels of the 1850s, a fascinating story, or my work as a tour guide in the Middle East. That all of that stuff is listed on my business card, and to take us all the way back to Nashville in like summer of 93, maybe a year later, summer of 94, I had created a business card and a business name, the Texas Camel Corps, even though I was living in Nashville. I knew that I needed to get back home to Texas, and I wanted camels of my own. And I thought that it was a bit brash, and it may have been putting the cart before the camel, so to speak, to get these business cards made, but I'm very goal-oriented. And if I had those business cards and it listed the various things that I purported to do with our camels, of which I had none at the time, then I knew it would force me to get my own camels and kind of fulfill that goal, make that goal manifest. So the business card that I have today is exactly the same as I had 20 years ago when I created it. Mm. And the driving goal is really kind of a part of the mission statement of Texas Camel Corps, which is to share our family's camels in unique and educational settings. And fortunately, the camel as a concept lends itself to all kinds of education and discovery, whether it's the U.S. Army camel experiment of the 19th century or whether it is desert ecology and environmental education. I can visit a school campus and maybe never even touch on the historic use of camels in Texas. We might not talk about historic exploration with camels throughout the ages because the science teachers have invited me there to use the camel kind of like a mobile classroom to talk about environmental adaptations. So these are the things that guide me, that drive me, that keep me motivated, is sharing these camels in unique and educational ways, but also I feel kind of like I'm the myth buster for camels. Everybody knows something about camels, and it tends to be wrong. All
right.
The tired old myths,
right.
You know,
right.
They're mean, they're nasty, they spit, they store water in their humps. None of this is empirically true from A to Z about camels, but everybody knows something about camels because their Aunt Ethel went on a ride in Turkey on a camel, and she had a bad experience and comes back, and somebody overhears her talking about her trip to Turkey at the dentist office and goes home and says, oh, I heard the lady in the dentist office talking about camels. And so that's what drives me, is having the opportunity to go out and hopefully positively impact impressionable students or, you know, patrons at libraries or museums or whatever. And I'll tell you, I've gotten no better disciples than my three kids. You know, they have grown up on a camel farm. And if you want to see their eyes just roll back in the back of their heads, just watch somebody come up to them and ask them about camel spitting or storing water in the hump. You know, my kids are like, you're kidding me. Doesn't everybody understand this? You know, maybe they take for granted the fact that, you know, they've grown up on a camel farm and not everybody does.
Right. You know, you used the term MythBuster, and I don't know if it was ever your intention when you started, but what you do now on Facebook in terms of myth-busting about people who are now your friends that live in Egypt, that's what it's all about. You know, you've been bringing all these people into Facebook, you know, interviewing people online. Where did that idea come from?
Well, you know, when you're hanging out in the desert with camels, you have a lot of time to You know, Facebook has been the most incredible dynamic, and I should say social media of all types. I don't have a Twitter account. I'm not in LinkedIn. I kind of make one technological step at a time. And, you know, three-ish years ago when I jumped on board with Facebook, I had no interest in it. I had friends who were using it. I saw them. And I spoke to a handful of folks. And I selected these, let's say, half dozen people, you included, for very specific reasons. And I asked basically the same question of everyone. What can Facebook do to help further my mission, you know, of sharing our camels or sharing the stories of camels or what we do on our tours in the Middle East? And virtually all of the half dozen really creative, kind of left of center thinking folks that I asked came back with a version of the same thing, and that is Facebook is whatever you want it to be. So I looked at what my panel, let's say, was doing with Facebook and how it was being used creatively and not in the same old way. And again, it's dynamic. Facebook is whatever the user wants it to be. And for some people, it is a fantastic tool for keeping up with family that is scattered far and wide. We learned that, you know, little junior soccer team went to the playoffs, and that is a great use of Facebook, keeping families that are spread out far and wide much closer together. It's a great use for grandparents. But I saw it as a way to kind of spread the gospel of the camel, if you will, and the different ideas that I want to spread. I thought, boy, this is viral. Because really, my best friend from high school probably doesn't need a camel. But he may have a friend who's a teacher or a youth minister at a church who may need camels for a live nativity. So from a business aspect, I saw how viral it was and how useful it could be. So some days I feel like I really exploit it in the best of ways, and other days I feel like, oh, man, I kind of hit a foul ball there. But, you know, hopefully it averages out, and we do some fun and exciting things with it.
You've posted some amazing photos of Egypt, and you've made some amazing friends there. And one of the pictures that I posted on my website to kind of introduce you is a picture of you in the desert with, I presume, two of your Texas friends, all with cowboy hats, and another bunch of guys that are Bedouins, and they're wearing the Bedouin hafeas, and you're all standing in a line. I don't know if anyone else gets that same thrill out of it that I do, but there is, it's just amazing. I mean, you are actually the second guy that I have met who wears a cowboy hat who also speaks Arabic. And the first time I heard both of you, I was just, I mean, there was just something bizarre, surreal about that. So one of the questions I have is, do you wear your cowboy hat when you go to Egypt? Because I would think that they would love that.
I do. Short answer, yes. Long answer, why? It provides shade. I'm the whitest guy on the planet, all right? And whether I'm working on my farm here in Texas or guiding a camel trek out in the Big Bend region of Texas, out in far west Texas, or guiding a camel trek in the Sinai or the Sahara, that shade goes with me. And it is no more political statement. It is no more fashion accessory. It is pure and total function. The word for it in Spanish is sombrero, which comes from the word sombra, or shade. So it literally is the giver of shade. And I have worn it for probably 10 or 11 years in the Middle East. And you know what? To really kind of lay all my cards out on the table, first trip I took over there in January of 2001, I didn't take my hat. I thought, you know what, I probably don't need to try and stick out too much. Well, here's what I didn't know. Cairo, here's what I didn't really understand. Cairo is the largest city in Africa. It's so cosmopolitan, I wasn't going to be the first white person that somebody in Cairo had seen. But it took me going over there, and it took me spending a month and living more with the Bedouin folk out in the desert than time spent in Cairo. But it took a month of living over there with folks in Egypt to realize that hat means nothing. It's quite functional, and I wish I'd had it. You know, I had a ball cap, I think. Maybe I wore a keffiyeh. But I've never taken a trip over without it. In fact, the flat that I keep in Giza, I have a whole wardrobe there, including my backpack, sleeping bag, camping gear, and a hat. I keep a hat over there full time. And the minute I walk out the door, you can bet this white face is getting covered up with that sombrero.
So when your Bedouin friends, I mean, I assume that everyone wants to try it on. All the guys want to try it on, I assume.
We have traded headgear in more pictures than you can imagine.
So what do they think of it?
They love it from a... Well, all the Bedouin have seen Western film, and by that I mean cowboy movies, and they know what that hat represents. And there's really something funny about when somebody puts on a cowboy hat that doesn't normally wear a cowboy hat, they automatically put their hands into the shapes of six-shooters. And yeah, they've seen cowboy movies.
Funny.
Oh, I can't tell you how many guests I've had who actually wear a cowboy hat or a Western hat. Hat of some type, and they end up, you know, trading headgear for a period of time with the Bedouin guides, and we've got many, many, many pictures of, you know, switching out headgear, but the one you mentioned with the three fellas in cowboy hats and six or eight Bedouin all in their traditional gear, it's one of my favorite pictures, and I've got a lot of pictures of groups in the Sinai, but that one, there's a real symmetry to it, where the three American guys in cowboy hats are placed within the group, the smiles, the arms around, shoulders, and that's one that really, really sticks out in my mind as well.
Okay, you're saying the Bedouin, they kind of adopt the Western attitude. Does it work the other way around? When you take American guests over to Egypt and they wear traditional garb, what happens to them? Do you see a difference?
Well, you know, it's funny because really the same theme or the same sense overcomes the person wearing the clothes, whether it be Western apparel or Bedouin gear or Middle Eastern attire. It's awkward at first, and it's a little odd. When the Bedouin wear a cowboy hat, sometimes they say, well, I can't see very clearly because, you know, they're used to being able to looking, you know, right off the end of their nose and up to the sky. The keffiyeh doesn't cast a wide brim like the hat, so there's kind of an awkwardness, and they end up, you know, looking, their eyebrows kind of jump about as they look up trying to see the sky, but the brim of the hat doesn't allow it. And then, likewise, if any of my guests put on ladies a scarf or guys a keffiyeh, you know, they end up fiddling with it incessantly. You know, they can never tie it right. They always have to go back to the Bedouin and dutifully sit there and have somebody tie it for them appropriately.
Mm-hmm,
And it's really funny. So the same thing happens. It's different for each, but it's the same reaction. It's awkward because it's so different.
Right, right. What has been the reaction for Americans that you take over there? Because you do some pretty extensive tours in Egypt, not just in the Sinai. Now you're going all over.
Yeah, there's not a corner of the country really that we can't go to now because of relationships I've built. I could certainly go somewhere that I've never been before, but I feel a lot better sharing relationships. It's not about the destination. It's not about the pyramids or the Sphinx or even the Nile River. It's about the people that I put my guests in contact with. At the end of the day, I feel like I'm the conduit, and it's the best job I've ever had. I get to introduce wonderful people to other wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
And in cases, I have to be a translator, but generally not. You know, I introduce you to her and them to you and kind of sit back and let those relationships grow in as much as they can over the period of time we're there. And to be completely honest, most of the folks I get, because of the nature of these trips, you know, we're not staying in five-star hotels. We're staying in the homes of people that I consider family now. And that alone kind of culls people out that might not be given to this type of travel, which is quite fine with me. You know, you want to travel with people you like.
Mm.
And from a business standpoint, maybe that doesn't always happen. In my case, it pretty much always does because of the type of trip that this is. I don't get many, you know, bumps on logs, people that aren't adventurous or flexible. Those types of folks aren't into this trip. They see the itinerary, see that we're going to be, in some cases, sleeping in the sand in the desert, moving day to day on camels, or, you know, we're sleeping in the house of my Egyptian family in Giza. This turns some folks off, and that's perfectly all right with me.
Mm-hmm. So when you're over there with these guests, what is... Because sometimes you're taking whole families over there.
And, those are the best. Those are the best.
Well, that's curious, because I was assuming that probably if you're taking a whole family, not everyone in the family is really sold on the idea, and that they have been and that they've been sold on this idea by their partner or by their parents.
Right.
So,
and there's a chance. There's a chance.
Has that happened? And have you noticed shifts?
You know, there's certainly varying degrees of drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, some folks are in whole hog, and others are a little less participatory. But at the end of the day, nobody books this trip that isn't into the idea or the concept. And the pre-trip correspondence and discussions and questions and answers and emails and phone calls that go back and forth are many, and they're deep. And the truth is, I try to scare folks off at the beginning. I'll say things like, what could you possibly do on this trip that could make me wish you hadn't come? You know, who walks into any retail establishment
right.
and expects to hear that from the salesman?
Right.
You know, the salesman is going to sell it. And at the end of the day, I do have to make a living. But you know what? This is my family we're talking about, not just my biological family here in Texas, but these two Egyptian families, one in Giza and one in Sinai. And these are folks I'm going to live with and have relationships with the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know that the folks who are paying me to take them over there are going to jump in feet first, be participants, not be observers. And really, I've been really lucky. I will knock on wood. I have had fantastic, fantastic luck. But I think it comes because of the dialogue ahead of time, the trip DVD that I've got, the video that kind of details where we're going to go, what we do, the relationships I've got. It's a heads up. Everybody understands what they're in for. Now, I think if we were looking for a real aha moment or a kind of a snapshot of discovery that folks have, without a doubt, it's always folks are surprised at the people. I think, by and large, most of my guests come understanding what it is I've tried to explain to them, but at the end of the day, they still want to go on a camel trek in the Sinai, or they want to visit the pyramids of Giza, and those are, as they head over, the things they think are going to be the most astounding. And I'm here to tell you, in a country like Egypt, the pyramids are the least impressive thing in that country, and they're incredible. But it's always the people. And it may not even be someone that I was planning on introducing you to. It might be a chance meeting at a bus stop. It might be a gesture that somebody makes to you at a restaurant, and I've had that happen trip after trip after trip. And at the end of the trip, one of my guests will say, you know what, that lady who offered me a Coca-Cola in the bus station, that was the sweetest gesture. And I'll kind of rib them. I'll say, what about the pyramids? And they go, oh, yeah, not so much. It's the people. And, you know, I think that's true anywhere. You could travel to Egypt. You could travel to Chile. You could even travel to Valley Mills, Texas. And I think you're going to find incredible, warm, generous, and hospitable people.
True. However, I always remember the first time that I went to Egypt. And before I had even left the airport, I had dinner invites. And they weren't dinner invites from people who, you know, whose sister has a shop that, you know, they sell tapestries.
Right.
They were genuine invites of people who were genuinely interested to meet me and to learn more about the outside world. So I think Egyptians are exceptional in that way. Now, of course, this is an exceptional time in Egypt for the last almost 2.5 years now since the revolution began. So how are you, you know, gauging the timing, the tours, where you're going, because you've got, you know, you don't want to disappoint people, you don't want to put people at risk. How are you going about that?
It has been, since revolution began, a really difficult balancing act. And I don't know if I've been fortunate or unfortunate to witness the progression of revolution firsthand, and I don't just mean from emails or Facebook or phone calls from my friends and family over there, but at key intervals since the revolution began, I've been able to be in Egypt. One was literally during the outbreak of revolution. I was there. I had just finished up a group. That group had left, and I was waiting for a second group to arrive. And unfortunately, the situation got so bad that the airport shut down, and that second group couldn't come. We did reschedule them for about 2.5 months later, and things had stabilized. So I was there at the outset of revolution. I came back 2.5 months later to see the country up and running in a functional state, although I would say it was a complete fashion. I have now been back a year after the revolution, twice this year, January and April, and I'm headed back again in September for another trip. And this may be the most exciting time to see this country. Right now in Egypt, there's a curfew going on in certain cities and in certain areas of those cities. It's not countrywide. Out in the desert, there is no curfew. There's no time frame. How can you impose a curfew on something that's timeless?
Right.
So this itinerary that I've got coming up for a tour in September is going to focus on the western desert, Bahariya Oasis.
Oh, which is fabulous area. It's one of
my
favorite parts of Egypt.
It is. And I can make you even more sick. We'll be in Siwa as well.
Oh, jeez. But
we're also taking a side trip to Jordan for about a week out of a 24-day period. So Jordan right now is very stable. So minus the week that I'll be in Jordan, the other 2.5 weeks in Egypt, we're spending a lot of time outside of Cairo and outside of the urban areas where these curfews have been imposed. In fact, it's a 30-day period of emergency law that has been enacted. So these curfews won't be going away anytime prior to my trip. And in fact, they'll still be enforced when I get there. So what does that mean to me and the itinerary that I'm guiding? It means that flights and arrivals for the guests have to come in during the non-curfew hours. So we're having to get creative with that. We have to think about traffic because folks can't do what they might normally do in the nighttime hours. So the traffic in a city of 19 million is going to be even hairier than normal. So we have to think about that. But I've got minimal days in Cairo, of course, being the capital. We're flying in and out of there. But the time in the western desert, I think, is going to probably be a lot like what my friends in those areas are telling me. We don't realize there's a revolution going on.
Right.
In those areas, things are still just running along status quo.
Right. And of course, you'll be connected to, you know, to all the news and, you know, news on the ground, because I know that there's a lot of times that the news that we're getting out here is very different from what the news is there. Even basic things like, you know, what antiquities are open and closed. You know, I got a news report from one newspaper saying that, you know, everything was closed. And yet a friend was saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'm looking down at this Luxor temple that I live near, and it's open. There's 20 tourists that just left, you know?
Yeah, it is always, I like to say that the news we receive here at home, for me in the U.S., is true, but it's only partially true.
Correct.
It's not the complete truth. And I don't think that, you know, there's something that's not being shared or that it's being hidden. I just think that just all the information isn't there, and this is also a very fluid situation. And here we are, you know, a good few thousand miles away trying to put it together. So here's some perspective. My friends and my family that live in Egypt, they're telling me we don't have the full picture. And I don't mean people who are Bedouin living out in the desert who might be a little disconnected or marginalized in general. I'm talking about educated folk who live in Cairo who say, you know, Doug, this is a movable situation. There's no consistency, and we don't quite know what to think right now as things aren't, you know, fully clear. And when I hear folks in Cairo explain that to me, I listen very, very closely, and I know, okay, then we need to be, you know, focused on things like transportation and routes we're going to take, and we want to avoid demonstration or protest areas because those can turn volatile. U.S. State Department warnings that have come out over the whole time of the revolution have basically echoed the same thing. You know, you should be alert about where you are and avoid demonstrations because these things can turn volatile in a minute. So these are the things that I'll be concerned with as we move about in Egypt and in Jordan too. But this itinerary has specifically been designed to take us out into desert areas. That's the focus of this trip.
Mm-hmm.
As we speak, there are the majority of antiquities are closed. The pyramids of Giza closed. You can't go there. You can't visit the Sphinx. And that's not good. But when those hallmarks of the country reopen, and they will much sooner than later, these are the things that give me hope.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that gives me hope, I was there at the beginning of the revolution when Mubarak was still in power, and his administration took out cell phones, internet, in some areas landlines as well, all right? So I've got quite a barometer to kind of gauge by. I've seen Egypt without basic communication, electronic communication, all right? I've seen airport in Cairo closed. So now those are kind of my yardsticks. And through this revolution, in fact, at the beginning, Morsi was tweeting his agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel there's significant progress in Egypt. I don't think you'll ever see a time that internet and basic electronic communication, social media, will be taken offline. I don't think you'll ever see that again. And today the airport is open, albeit they've got some restricted hours because of emergency law and the curfews that's in place. But as long as that airport's open, I'll probably be flying in and out.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Yeah, I think it also depends about what kind of person that you ask. In Egypt, they're just like people anywhere. You ask one person and they're going to be very doom and gloom. You ask another person, they'll see the brightness of something. So after you do this trip in September, what's on your schedule? Do you have anything stateside in America that people who may not want to be quite so adventurous?
I've got some camel treks planned for out west in West Texas in the Big Bend region.
Oh, another fantastic area.
Oh, it is, yeah. The Chihuahuan Desert, which is North America's largest desert. It's wonderful, wonderful history out there. It ties in, for me, historically, with the U.S. Army camel experiment of the 1850s. So I've got both public land and private land out there that I can guide on, and I've made some agreements with some new landowners out there just west of Fort Davis, where the U.S. Army camel experiment partially took place. And it's beautiful terrain, beautiful topography, incredible history. So this fall we're going to run a couple of trips out there. That's something people can join up with. And, of course, we're dragging the camels all over the state to schools, libraries, historical sites, some of the frontier forts where the camels actually did their work in the 19th century. We'll be participating in living history events there, all telling the story of the camels.
And the first camels that came to America from the Middle East, was that Morocco that they came from?
Well, camels were purchased from across North Africa and the Middle East. When the U.S. Army went camel shopping in 1855 after congressional order, the U.S. Congress said, looks like we need some pack animals out west that can handle the desert. Mules and horses and oxen were starting to suffer as folks were crossing west following Manifest Destiny and, of course, the gold rush of the 1840s. The U.S. Army sent a sailing ship across to North Africa. They actually bought camels from what are now the countries of Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, and Turkey, and sent this ship over twice. It is one of the most incredible tales ever. They brought 34 camels on the first shipment, 41 on the next, landed them just off the Gulf Coast at a little town called Indianola, which is not quite midway between Houston and Galveston. At the time, it was a thriving port, which rivaled Galveston for commerce. But unfortunately, a couple of hurricanes have taken their toll on Indianola, and there's not much left there. But the folks of Calhoun County down there and their historical commission really value the connection that camels have to their county's history. And there are lots of historical markers and even a camel a metal sculpture there on the beach that helped to remind folks about the role the camels played in establishing and settling frontier Texas.
That's amazing bit of history. And you have you walked that route before, or you were planning
have
to?
Have I? Oh, man. In 2006, some buddies and I decided we wanted to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Army camel's arrival in 1856. So we hoofed it from Indianola on the Gulf Coast all the way up to Camp Verde in the Texas Hill Country, northwest of San Antonio. It was 15 days, 215 miles, and it was one of a handful of experiences that I've been able to do with camels in my life that just transformed me. None of us had done anything like that before. The landscape of Texas is very, very different today than it was in 1856. There are modern highways. There are private ranches that bisect the route the camels would have taken. So in places we weren't able to follow the exact route. We ended up on U.S. Highway 87 for a whole lot longer than I would have liked, let me tell you.
You know,
18-wheelers speeding
oh,
by.
No.
But I'll tell you what, I've done a couple of these events now commemorating various routes the Army camels took, and there is absolutely nothing like walking 3 miles an hour, or in cases riding, along an interstate as cars and trucks go by at 70, 80 miles an hour, for you to realize that, you know, we don't have to be in such a hurry.
Yeah.
Now, the overarching goal of the two different events that I've done like that were to share the history of the camels, but I think those of us who were in the caravans each time, I think we got so much more out of it than we ever imagined. And it could only happen because you're moving along at 3 miles an hour.
Right. So the people who go on your camel treks in, say, Big Bend, do you feel that they take some of that away with them? Do they experience that?
Boy, I sure hope so. You know, I tell folks that if you're driving through that landscape, for argument's sake, let's say the Chihuahuan Desert, or really the Sinai or the Sahara, and you're, you know, breezing through in a four-wheel drive, or you're up on a modern highway, cruising along at 70 miles an hour, you're not living in that environment. And there's nothing like taking you out of the air-conditioned car, 70 miles an hour and putting you on the ground with a camel carrying all your gear, you see every cactus, you see every tree, you see every stone, you hear every chirp from every bird. Only way you're going to get that is by living in that environment. And you know what? We're there 2 days, 3 days on these treks, but it is enough to take people, myself included, out of that hustle and bustle and out of that hurried mindset. And I'm as guilty as anybody else. I've got a truck, I've got air conditioning, I've got satellite radio in there, I've got a smartphone. But man, when you get out into these far reaches of deserts, whether they're in the Middle East, Africa, or Texas, there's just something that overcomes you, and you realize that I can slow down. Maybe it'll just be for 3 days, but maybe you take a pinch of that back with you into the workaday life.
Absolutely. Oh, it's so important. Do you have cell phone reception out there in Big Bend? And, but most importantly, do you encourage people to turn their cell phones off?
You know, when I started guiding treks out there back in 98, cell phones weren't quite as ubiquitous as they are today. And I remember my earliest printed communication I would have with the groups would be, leave your cell phones in your car, you know, at headquarters or where we start, or, you know, don't bring them on the trip. A, you know, reception is non-existent, and how annoying would that be anyway? But you know what? They've become ubiquitous. They are everywhere. They're omnipresent. Nowadays, cell reception does reach a lot of the pockets of the more far-flung places that I guide. And from a safety standpoint, it's great. We're in a remote area. If someone were bitten by a snake or if they tripped and fell, it's best that we have communication with the outside world. Mm-hmm. And I don't rue them quite as much as you would think. And besides, they are all, they're so handy for taking photos of the groups everybody wants.
True.
So, you know, instead of ruining the technology, I'm looking at it and seeing, how can we use this? How can we capitalize on it and do something positive with it? And I recognize that going on a camel trek might be a once-in-a-lifetime thing for some people. And heck, if they've got a smartphone with a camera, why not have it there? So I'm not quite as, you know, ugly and persistent about it as maybe I once was.
I hope people listening to this will just be so inspired to join you at some point on one of your treks. Or if not on a trek, one of your trips to a library to show the camels.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we get a call, three or four times a year from a Middle Eastern restaurant or an Oriental rug company that maybe is doing something special. And, you know, I'll do what I've got to do to feed my family to a degree. But those things, to me, they've got a cultural tie. So, heck yeah, I'm going to do it.
So how often are your three kids going to be helping you this season?
They're cheap labor. You can figure that out. They're going to be there.
Well, Vanessa, is Vanessa in university?
She is. She's halfway through with an anthropology degree and perhaps a double major in Middle East Studies and Arabic. So,
wow.
I think we know who's going to take over the family business.
I think so.
No, the kids are all involved. They are all very, very capable. But they've also got dreams and aspirations of their own. And if camels don't, you know, fall into those dreams and aspirations, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was a pro baseball player when he was younger. He went into broadcasting and owns radio stations. My mom was a professional musician, and I kind of tried on each of those hats a little bit at a time throughout my youth and my young adulthood, and I don't think that either of my parents would have been, you know, disappointed that I didn't follow in their footsteps. And, and all I want for my kids is that they be super happy doing what they're doing, and whatever it is they're doing, I know they're going to be great at it and have a fun time doing.
That's great. So if anyone wants to find out where your gigs are, how is the best way for them to do that?
Well, the homepage for our website, texascamelcorps.com, always has our schedule of events. Summertime is pretty slow, so the calendar gets taken down generally June, July, August. But for the rest of the year, for all the public events that we're doing, they're always listed there. Of course, on Facebook, I promote what we're going to do with the camels. And, you know, we have folks come to the farm who want to visit. And maybe they're here for an hour, maybe a day, maybe a week. I just had two cousins from Czech Republic come and stay at the farm. They wanted to learn camel handling. So they said, you know, hey, we're willing to do some work on the farm in exchange for, you know, kind of an apprenticeship. So, you know, you can come and hang out with these camels in virtually any scenario you want it to be.
Does that mean that they get food cooked by you? Because I have to say, I have. Do some mean Indian dishes, too.
Well, the repertoire here on the farm in the kitchen, it could be Indian, which actually we're having tonight.
I wasn't invited.
Oh, yeah. We'll save you a plate.
Okay.
We've got Middle Eastern fare, Mexican, Ethiopian, and, of course, good old American cuisine. But the family, fortunately, has been very patient with my experimentation in the kitchen.
Oh, I know. One more thing I wanted to ask you before I let
ma'am.
You go. You've got a camel hair tent, don't you?
It's a goat hair tent.
Goat hair tent.
And then the walls are a combination of wool and camel hair. It's really funny. We rent our farm, okay? You'd be amazed at how difficult it is to find a place that's camel ready. So we rent our farm, but the first house I've ever owned was a Bedouin goat hair tent. It's completely authentic, brought over piece by piece as I could. They're big, you know, so I've had to take the roof in half at times, and I bring back wall panels, and the thing is almost complete. And, you know, I guess if things go really bad, at least I've got camels, I've got a house,
you've got
the camels
a house.
Can carry the tent. I'm ready.
And you set that up sometimes at the farm and at different events, I think?
Without a doubt. Yeah, hey, when you own a mobile house like that, you're proud of it. You know,
yes.
You want to share it in any setting you can. But no, if we did something at the Bullock State History Museum in Austin, Texas. They had an IMAX showing of a 3D Arabia movie, and they wanted cultural programs, so we had the camels on the front lawn of the museum, set up the goat hair tent, and I'll tell you what, structures, housing, everybody loves this thing. And if you think about it, when you were a kid, in your living room, you might take blankets and chairs and you'd build a fort, right?
Right.
So people like building forts, and I can set up that Bedouin tent on the lawn of an art museum or a history museum or as part of a cultural display, and it's welcoming. People always walk right in and sit down on the Bedouin rugs right on the ground. Everybody does it as if they've done it in a past life or it's something familiar and comfortable to them, and it's great.
Wow,
that's
interesting. That's fascinating.
Fantastic.
Huh. Well, and it's kind of like, it's almost like going back to our roots is what it sounds like, because, I mean, chairs must be a pretty recent introduction to civilization.
For sure, and if you have that stuff, those extra things like chairs, you've got to carry them.
You know,
so the Bedouin life, the nomad life, is all about functionality and minimalism. Any one item that a Bedouin has is going to serve three or four purposes. A camel can carry a lot, but it can only carry so much. And that life, I've learned so much from them.
Okay. I am definitely going to cut you off there, because if we start talking about nomadism and materialism and the stuff that we all have in our houses that we don't need, we're going to go on for another hour. So we'll leave that to next time. But Doug, thank you. This has been so very, very interesting. Thank you for being here and answering all my questions and educating even more people. Thank you.
Pleasure was mine. Thanks for having me.
Tune in next week for another great conversation on All Over the Map from Lorraine Chidock's cabin in Chile and locations around the globe.